Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening on our podcast or live on our website, welcome to you as well. That's 989fm.com.au. It's really good to have your company this morning. A bit rainy up in Brisbane, but I think we need the rain. I've been waiting for it a bit. It's been a bit hot. Now, today on the program, really the most common question that white Australians will ask Aboriginal people always revolve around issues of identity. And it's a subject that keeps propping up in the mainstream media, whether it's Andrew Bolt talking about white Aborigines supposedly gaining benefits, or the Australian newspaper's biennial coverage of certificates of Aboriginality and definitions. There seems to be this continual obsession with what is actually a very personal issue of an Aboriginal person's identity. But of course, the way the media talks about it, it's only a very, very small part of it. And it seems to be largely framed around benefits. Now, our guest today is Professor Bronwyn Carlson. She's an Indigenous Studies lecturer at the University of Wollongong and the author of The Politics of Identity, Who Counts as Aboriginal Today? It was her PhD on the subject won the coveted Stanner Prize Award from IATSIS. And she's also this week's Indigenous ex-host on Twitter, and we often have the founder of that, Luke Pearson, as a regular guest. So I'm very excited to have Professor Carlson on this morning. How are you today?
Good morning, Amy. Thank you so much for taking the time to have me on your show. I'm very excited about it this morning.
No, I'm excited to be talking to you. First of all, we always ask our guests, where's your country and what's your mob?
Yeah, so these are sometimes really complex questions for Indigenous Australians. So my history, of course, our family originates from South Australia several generations ago, but I was born here on Dharawal country and have grown up part of my life here and part of my life all over Australia and including New Zealand. So the issues of identity for me were really complex.
Yeah.
We've done family tree stuff, we've found our family, where they originate from. But do we say that that's our country? Is that where we're from?
Right.
We don't know. That's really complex for us.
Did you grow up having a good sense of your Aboriginality and what that meant?
Well, I was born in the 60s, and that was a particularly interesting time in Australian history. And so as a young child, I grew up my early years here in the Illawarra, and then we were relocated around Australia quite often, and I write about our journey of around Australia in my book. So I had my early years in Unundata in South Australia. I also went to school and we lived in Geelong in Victoria. We came back to the Illawarra quite regularly, staying here. And then as a young child, my father decided to take us to New Zealand
right.
Because he thought that we'd have a better life. Well, that was our understanding of it. Wasn't much of a better life for us. It kind of mirrored our growing up here in Australia, which was mostly around dislocation,
right?
A lot of alcohol-infused events, a lot of violence, and a lot of displacement, really. And so after a short period of time, my father returned to Australia and left us there. So my mother and my two sisters and my younger brother left us in New Zealand. And of course, as Australian citizens, we weren't entitled to any kind of assistance from the New Zealand government.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I write about how I thought we were poor before we went to New Zealand. And when we were there, I realised that perhaps we weren't quite so poor as I thought. Having nothing and relying on handouts from the church really made me an angry young person. We were dislocated from our family and our cousins,
yeah.
So we grew up in isolation just with my immediate siblings. Got into a fair bit of trouble over there growing up and feeling that sense of abandonment and that sense of dislocation from family,
right.
And not having a really good understanding of the sense of belonging. We grew up understanding that we were not white, but we grew up in an era where being considered Aboriginal meant you had to be black in colour. And so we grew up with this under this kind of shadow of you're touched by the tar brush,
which,
you know, basically means we understand you're not white, but we're not letting you be black either. So we grew up with this kind of shadowy kind of idea of who we were. And, of course, going to New Zealand and having that displacement really shook our sense of, you know, self and who we were. So even now, when I, you know, coming back to Australia, people say to me, that's a Kiwi accent. Are you a Kiwi? And I'm like, no, no. I'm, you know, Aboriginal. I'm born here. And they'll be like, well, that's a bit weird. Listen to your accent. So all of those things kind of cohere together and create this kind of volatile environment of trying to understand who you are.
Did that sort of feed into why you wanted to start studying Aboriginal identity, largely because of your personal story and just that complex interwoven narrative that you have around your identity?
Well, like, I guess in some ways, like when I was 15, I got deported from New Zealand for being uncontrollable, which is quite humorous, me and my younger sister in tow, and we got sent to live in Katherine in the Northern Territory
with my
father, who really didn't want us. So I remember we'd get in trouble all the time for, why are you hanging out with the, you know, the Aboriginal people in town? And that's a really racist town in the 80s. I, you know, recall lots of really violent episodes towards Aboriginal people in that town, which kind of sent a fear through us about really identifying. I, you know, witnessed a person shoot an Aboriginal person on their property with salt in a shotgun.
Oh, wow. That's in the 80s.
What? That's in the 80s, 1980.
So that really changes. I mean, it seems to me identity can be very fluid because there's, even across time, there's different sort of ways it's seen. And it seems like in Katherine in the 80s, it would have been a disadvantage to be, oh, well, it's always been, I guess, a disadvantage to be Aboriginal. But there was a way that you were scared, I guess, to view yourself as Aboriginal because of that fear.
Absolutely. I remember me and my sister were picked up because we were not particularly phenotypically dark or anything, and we were picked up for hanging out with the blacks in the town, and we got this talking to, like, you don't want to be hanging out with those people.
Right.
And we were like, I think we're those people. So it was, like, really interesting times, like being picked up, told to, you know, you don't need to be hanging out with those people. And I remember being told at school, you'll amount to nothing except being a cleaner, because that's what your people, you know, that's all you can do. And I'm like, well, that's strange. One minute you're too white, next minute you're definitely Aboriginal. Like, what's going on here? This is a really confusing time. And I hate cleaning, by the way. So I'd love to go back and say that.
I think you're in the right career right now.
You're definitely not a cleaner. So, you know, it didn't last long in Katherine. Nothing to do with the town, obviously, and the people there. It's just, you know, the relationship with my father didn't want us. That's why he left us in New Zealand, left us for dead there. So that was never going to work out. So I came back to Wollongong, and I was here with my nan, and that's the only kind of, you know, safe haven was in that place with her, because it's the only place that I felt a sense of, oh, I belong here, because of the longevity of her life there. But other than that, the dislocations had a real impact on myself and seeing myself as an Aboriginal person.
It's really interesting because a lot of Aboriginal people, their identity is tied directly to the land and to that sense of belonging, but your identity wasn't so much tied to your traditional country. It was tied to a completely different place because of that displacement.
Absolutely. So for me, this place here, the Illawarra, I never say I'm a Dharawal person, but I feel at home here. This is a place where my nan was, and my great nan and my mum, and, you know, everyone's from here. So I have a sense of being, you know, in this place. So when I, as an adult, when I came back to Australia, I had this real strong sense I needed to come to the Illawarra. Just every time you come over that escarpment and you look down at the Illawarra, it pulls you down. You know, this is the place where you need to be. It's just overwhelming, you know, that I have the sense that this is my place. But, you know, the idea of going to university and all that stuff was still not even on the agenda for me as a young person. So coming back here, had four kids. My husband is actually Maori. So that might add to the accent.
I'm picking up a little bit of your accent now.
Yeah, picking up the accent. But when I came back down here, I was, like, really interested in doing more family tree stuff because of my dislocation from place and family. I've got loads of cousins and stuff around here, but I didn't grow up with any of them.
Yeah.
So it's really quite sad. I have one cousin who I'm quite close to because we were close in age. And when I was a teenager and came back here, I spent a lot of time with her. But the rest is this dislocation. And I think if you don't have that history with people, it's quite hard, you know, to just reconnect and be back in there.
Yeah.
So that part's been quite hard. But so, yeah, I was doing family tree stuff and really interested in, you know, my family in this place and found lots of interesting stuff. And someone mentioned to me that the University of Wollongong at the Aboriginal Education Centre at the time had lots of photos and pictures and stuff around local area. And I thought, oh, that'd be really interesting. I'll go and check that out. This is the first time, and this was in 1998, that I ever set foot on a university campus. They just were not part of my world.
And growing up from a girl who was told that she would probably amount to a cleaner to someone who now has a PhD and has a book and has won all these awards, it really shows how low expectations are tied to that Aboriginal identity, doesn't it? Because you've obviously come such a long way since those early days.
Oh, absolutely. If we keep telling our young people that they're not going to amount to anything, you know, the struggle for them to actually overturn that kind of deficit thinking is really hard. I remember when I went to that university, and it was Glenn Williams, an Aboriginal man from Nowra, who was the student support officer there, and I told him what I was doing, and we chatted for ages, and he said, why don't you come to university? And I thought it was the most ludicrous thing I'd ever heard in my life. I didn't even finish year 10. Yeah. I was homeless. I didn't have anywhere to stay, and, school was not high on my priority. At that point in time, I got a job in a factory. I spent years sewing in factories. I can whip up men's shirts in seconds. I spent years doing that. And, so when he said that to me, you know, I was really quite scared. And he said, well, come along to this alternate admissions program. And that's why I'm a big supporter of those kinds of things in our institutions, because they recognise that Aboriginal people have not always had an easy pathway to university, but they also recognise your history.
Yeah.
You know, you bring to the table lots of things, not just, you know, a certificate from school, years of experience of, and that could be about dislocation, that could be about anything, but you bring that. So I went and sat the test, and I wasn't even the oldest one there, interesting. So my good friend, Auntie Rita, Timbury Bennett was there, and she was in her late 60s at the time. And, we sat the test together, and we got in, and we thought that was a hoot. And they said, oh, yeah, you know, we're going to offer you a place at the university. And I just looked at them and thought, what does that even mean? what does that mean? So anyway, we had to sit down and work out all the things you wanted to study. And I was really drawn to sociology and Aboriginal studies, as it was called back then, because I thought, imagine understanding how the world works and imagine having a bigger base of knowledge about our histories. I thought, oh, that's got to work. So that's what I did. I went to university, but it wasn't all, you know, clear sailing. And I often tell this story to some of my students. In my first lecture, so I go along, I was really nervous because I was in my late, you know, mid to late 30s and had four kids at home and, no background of HSC or understanding everything that's going on around me here. So I rock on up to this lecture, and I remember the lecturer talking about this guy called John Ra. And I was like, I don't know who it is. He's obviously important. So I wrote it on my notepad, find out who the hell John Ra is. You know, this person's got to be important in this space. And as time went on, I was having a lot of difficulty understanding, you know, the language that's used in that space. Like, I didn't understand discursive. I didn't understand discourse. Yep. I didn't understand what these words meant. And I went to my class, and my sociology tutor at the time said to me, you know, it's just all about unlocking that language. Get a sociology dictionary. And she said, you know, you should be here. You need to come to university. This is going to be great. So I was like, oh, good. So I went down and got that sociology dictionary, and I looked it up and found out that John Ra was actually genre, and he wasn't a man at all. And, you know, it sounds quite funny, and I feel quite stupid not knowing any of that stuff, but I didn't. But
that's very fair enough, given your history. You know, it has nothing. The knowledge and intelligence is completely different, I guess.
So yeah, absolutely. So, but once those keys are unlocked, the potential for everyone and any one of us to soar in that space is unbelievable. And I've seen it with our young students as well. You know, when you take the time, which I always do, I have a big commitment to Indigenous students when they come to uni, spend time making sure that they understand the environment and survive. And, man, I see some awesome stuff.
And I guess working with those young Aboriginal students, considering your history and growing up with that understanding of Aboriginal identity, do you see the same issues sort of in the new generation coming through, that we're still grappling with these same issues of identity?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like every year in my class, I have lots of Aboriginal people, and they range from people who are very strong in their identity and have great community links and a great understanding of who they are, from people who come up to me and go, oh, I have some Aboriginal in me, you know, but my dad won't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's this big range, big gamut of kind of stories that come, and people come and they're really, you know, heartfelt and upset about their, you know, life histories. They're like, I want to know more. I want to, you know, connect with the side of my family. I want to have a better understanding of who I am, but where do I start? And I get that. I still get emails today, like people are saying, oh, you know, I've read your book. How can I do it? And I think, well, the point of the book is not for me to give a roadmap.
Yep.
For how people do that, because that definitely wasn't the point of the book. But I understand people's pain, and where do we go? Where do people go to find out in this, you know, mess in the aftermath of all the colonial violence? Where do you go?
It's interesting.
And I think it's Oh, sorry, Amy.
No, sorry, I was just going to say it's interesting that there's that one definition, the federal definition, I guess, of who is an Aboriginal person. But there's obviously a lot of complexity in between those sort of three-pronged definition, and you were talking in your book that you found 67 definitions of what it is to be an Aboriginal person, which is obviously such a broader view than what we're used to hearing.
Well, that's only in our law. So that's in law, 67 definitions. But outside of law and policy documents and research, there's thousands. And so that's one of the reasons I wanted to map all that stuff in the book, is because I was like, you know, where do we get to the point we are today in understanding who gets to count or who doesn't? Like, where do we come up with these ideas? And that's why I thought, oh, it's really important to go back and start thinking about when we was first written about. And so, of course, my focus in the book is of people who are might be, you know, called mixed heritage, or, you know, just finding out, or have some dislocation in their history. So that is the focus. And so I decided to find all the documents that spoke about part Aboriginal or mixed and all those kind of terms. And at first I thought, I'm hardly going to be able to find anything.
Yep.
I found enough documents I could literally build a house out of.
Wow.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. My room, it was just stacked up. And I remember saying to my supervisor, Martin Nakata, oh, there's so much, I can't read that stuff. Look at it all. And it was a little depressing reading it, I have to say. The way in which researchers, you know, policies, legal documents, all described us.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the interesting things is, depending on which state or territory, things change significantly. Like up in Queensland, in an earlier study by a woman called Biddle, she found that some Aboriginal people who would see themselves as Aboriginal were actually excluded from the study because they were deemed a percentage of blood, or that they were a female and married non-Aboriginal person, so they were deemed not eligible for the study, and that people who hung out with Aboriginal people who could come from other cultural groups were deemed Aboriginal because they hung out with them.
So when you get a sense of these researchers and people who are defining Aboriginal, like what place did they come from when they were trying to define it? I mean, they obviously had no real understanding. They had no basis. They were just basically making it up. Is that basically what you found? A lot of people are just making up these definitions.
Yeah, well, it does seem a little that way, but you have to remember that all of these policy documents and all of this research comes from Australia's history with anthropology. So, you know, Australia was deemed this place where anthropologists could come and study the dying race, you know, us mob who were going to, you know, eventually die out. So there was this kind of salvage anthropology where we had to hurry up and document, you know, everything about them before they passed on, naturally, of course. And then what happened is, when that didn't happen, clearly, then the focus turned on, well, how can we measure their road to assimilation? How can we measure them as they progress to white society?
So that would explain the part Aboriginal and the quadroons and...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The goal has always been assimilation in this you know, country. And I was talking to Michael Anderson some time ago, and he said to me, everything our government does, that's the underlying message, is assimilation, always. And I think it's true. When you look at all this documents, every single thing was a measurement towards how close they're getting to white society. And Yeah, it's really, really interesting when you know, things that are measured are cleanliness, ability to take care of children,
right.
You know, dressing well, acting white, all of these kind of bizarre things are in all this research.
And it's interesting because it informs the way we view it today, the debate around identity, because it is focused on certificates of Aboriginality, who isn't an Aboriginal person, and it's very much led by the mainstream media. So it's almost they're trying to weed out the people who aren't and who are Aboriginal. I mean, I think it even feeds into the way we view it today and the way it's carrying out today.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Everything that's taking place in contemporary Australia has its roots in this historical kind of foundation of or corpus of knowledge. It definitely all stems from there. So the likes of Bolt and some of his comments, you know, when you see all the stuff in the media about, you know, the confirmation of Aboriginality and all the people jumping on board the gravy train and all this sort of stuff, what it's telling the Australian mainstream public is that these people of mixed descent are undeserving.
Yep.
Because they're not real. And so it continues that same flavour that's coming through in all of these research reports from historically throughout Australia that say that, well, these people aren't real Aboriginal people. These ones are. And so real ones are somewhere else and they're dying out.
Yep.
And that is still the kind of focus that they have today. And so all of these other ones are literally undeserving because they should identify as Australian as opposed to Aboriginal.
They should just assimilate.
They don't look it.
Yeah, they should just assimilate.
Absolutely.
Pretty much what
and
they're
they
saying.
Should leave behind their sense of Aboriginality. That's the thing. So, you know, I get students at work who always say, oh, yeah, but, you know, now Aboriginal people are living in the white man's world. And I always find that such an interesting concept. Since when has this been the white man's world?
Yeah.
Come on. This is our world. There is only one world. So we're not living, you know, in our world and then trying to assimilate into this world. That's ludicrous. There is one world and we reside in it. And just because we have a car or a flat screen TV doesn't mean we are not Aboriginal and that we are suddenly becoming white folk. And because it's always interesting that, what you know, the white population are allowed, their cultures are allowed to evolve and include new technology,
yep.
But ours aren't. Like, come on. And, you know, just the other day I've had a student say to me, if the British didn't come here, there wouldn't be civilization and technology.
I sometimes wonder how kids like this make it to uni with that view. I'm just always amazed because it's a common view I hear from people, you know, colleagues of mine who are in uni, you know, white people who never had any contact with Aboriginal people and seem to have this view. It always amazes me just how common it is.
It is very common, but this year I decided to take the approach that at least they're in the class and at least they're here to learn.
That's
so
true.
I thought, well, this is going to be my approach this year. So, you know, I called her in and I said, well, let's look at those ideas about what is civilization. And, you know, she was really, you know, astounded to realize that Aboriginal people already have these complex systems of knowledge, always have, always will have. And I said to her, and even though things change, like all cultures, so even though in urban settings some people use English terms, they're still embedded with the cultural practices. And so she finally started getting it. And I said, let's talk about technology. When the British arrived here, you know, they arrived with, you know, and she's talking about their guns and gunpowder. And I said, which literally belonged to the Chinese. But so it's not British. And, you know, their weaponry was actually not as superior as Aboriginal weaponry and technology at the time. It just wasn't. Yeah. It would take you 6 to 10 minutes to load a musket. How many, you know, a superb marks, you know, person, an Aboriginal person with weaponry could take that person out in seconds?
Yeah.
You know, so they have to stop thinking about this from a viewpoint of the victor.
Yeah.
And have to actually open their mind to realise that nothing is just quite that black and white.
I guess it all leads back to that dehumanisation of Aboriginal people, because that leads to you don't think of their society, our society, as real societies. You don't think of our land management systems as complicated. It all feeds back into identity and believing that Aboriginal people were a dying race and that you can breed them out. I guess it's all connected in that way, those sort of viewpoints that that student had.
Oh, absolutely. It's so connected. And when we talk to them about the ideas of race and racism and the ideas about, you know, the way race is being used, for example, in social Darwinism, and combine that with the thinking around the great chain of being, and how when people, you know, non-Indigenous people first come here, they already have preconceived ideas about the people they're going to be meeting. And they already think, well, they're a dying race, they're primitive, they're not going to be here anyway. And so that definitely dehumanizes the entire population. Because you can't commit those kind of atrocities upon people if you think they're human.
Yeah.
You know, that's just, you know, that's, you can see the same thing that, you know, that Hitler did. He dehumanized the entire Jewish population so that people literally did not see them as human.
When we... I was just going to say, when we do have these debates around identity, and particularly the after the Bolt class action, obviously that was when it was at its height, but even just recently with the Australian newspaper, do you see that, I mean, just constantly having these debates from a white Australian perspective around identity, do you see that as a form of that continuing dehumanisation?
Absolutely. It's ongoing colonial violence. That's what we need to call it, because the people like Bolt who are in a particular position of power, and his kind of attacks on people, apart from, even if you set aside that most of what he said was lies to start with, and I mean, that's why he's found guilty, but his constant focus on people who he sees as undeserving because they won't identify as Australian solely.
Yeah.
And so he cannot get his head around that people would be proud to be Aboriginal and, you know, recognise their cultural identity and their connections to kinship, etc., if they don't look a particular way to him. He just can't fathom that, and it's so embedded in his racist ideas about what Aboriginal and who and what Aboriginal people are. You know, it's never going to end. And, you know, there are certain media outlets that focus on this, and it's interesting if you look at which ones they are, because you can kind of track it. And so even this new stuff around, you know, people claiming to be to be Aboriginal is fraudulent to gain benefits. Whenever it's in the media, it's always identity connected to benefits.
Yeah.
And one of the things I said to my students the other day, you know, go out there and find me all the benefits that are connected with being an Aboriginal person. And I thought, good, if they find heaps, I'll get in line. But if they don't, it'll be an interesting conversation. And it was interesting because the things that they thought Aboriginal people got for free were ludicrous. Free dogs, free wedding dresses.
I have not heard any of those two. I've heard the free cars and the free bus rides.
Oh, yes,
I've never heard the wedding dresses and the dogs.
The wedding dresses and the home loan, free home loan, oxymoron, stupidity. But even in saying it, people don't even recognise the stupidity in it.
Yeah.
Why on earth would a group of people in a country like Australia get a free dog?
Yes.
Like what? Yeah, so they don't even see that. And the other day on campus we had a tent up as part of a fair, and I think there were some young people there advocating for the Recognise campaign. That's not part of the story really. They were just there and it was identifiably an Aboriginal kind of thing. A guy was walking past and the young girl stepped out and said, oh, do you want to sign the petition? And he said, no, F off. Those Abos get everything for free.
Yes. And I mean, I guess...
I'm like, what the hell? This is at university. This is where, you know, a learned space where people of higher intelligence are supposed to work.
some higher intelligence. I just wonder, I mean, talking to you, it seems to be this continual tying of identity to benefits does seem to spread that lie that Aboriginal people do get more than other people. It spreads that lie that there isn't a real disadvantage and human rights injustices occurring daily to black folks. These continual stories about identity and linking it to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's always linked to that, and that because it incites that hatred. And if it incites the hatred, then it puts the focus on Aboriginal people to be undeserving and not real.
Yeah.
And that's all that's about. So even if you look at the people in the Bolt case, all of those people that he pointed his finger at saying that these are undeserving people, why they're claiming to be Aboriginal only so they can get benefits, every single one of those person worked hard for every single position that they're in. You know, nobody got to go to uni for free. They paid for it.
Yeah.
They worked hard and handed in their assignments and graduated. And that's a celebration as far as I'm concerned. Artists, you know, all the people that he, you know, had a focus on were all people who had spent their lives working hard to achieve something for themselves and their families.
Yeah.
And we should celebrate that they were able to do that. These are great role models. It's all just boils straight down to racism. And for someone like Bolt, who's in a privileged, powerful position, to turn around and say to Aboriginal people who have, through their hard work, you know, manage to have good professions or whatever, for somebody in his position to turn around and go, they only got to this place by pretending to be Aboriginal,
yep,
is actually, you know, come on, look at you.
Yes. I think a lot of people would agree with that. He talked about being a martyr of free speech, and he was the victim, no one else. You know, I think it was pretty outrageous. Yeah. It was outright
offensive. A powerful white man was the victim of these Aboriginal people for speaking back to him. Give me a break. You know, come on. And he was rewarded with his own show on Channel 10. Come on.
It's amazing. It's mind-blowing. But at the same time, Australia continues. I mean, you're talking about the historical legacy. It's continuing.
And I think it will for some time. We are not done with it. Our history is not done with it. No. It will continue. And the ongoing colonial violence is evident all around us. We see that with the forced removal of country. We see that with the intervention. We see that with basic cards and all those kinds of things. And while those things might be something that communities want to discuss themselves, like basic cards and all those types of things, when the government rolls it out and targets Indigenous communities, that's a problem.
Yes, very true.
You know, that's a big problem. Andrew Bolt, like, come on, nobody should even be listening to this fool. Somebody who has to build their reputation on lying about people should tell you something about their character. And I think that the people who took him to court showed a much higher level of character. They didn't get involved in any mudslinging or anything. They just said, you broke the law, and the law's here to protect people.
Yeah. Very true.
So I think that they're quite brave, because really they put their entire identity on the line for people to scrutinise.
That's very true.
And that's what happens.
I was just wondering, in relation to your book and your work around identity, I mean, across the world with Indigenous populations, particularly those in sort of developed nations, it seems to be I wonder if it's a common story, but we do have different ways of identifying. For example, in North America and in Canada, there does seem to be very different ways that nations and individual nations choose to identify. And I'm wondering if there is any sort of comparison that you've made in your research, or how you see the international experience and where we stand internationally.
Well, I guess that you can see some common themes for Indigenous populations around the world, particularly those who have been colonised by the British. We see some similar violence taking place. But we see different things happening in different countries depending whether they have a treaty or other kinds of settlement. Yeah. But that doesn't even mean that those people are doing much better in any way, that disadvantage is not part of their everyday experience, because it is. But it's interesting with the latest kind of articles that took place about ID cards, and that just sends, you know, horrors down my spine.
It's
at
very
the thought.
Scary. Yeah, and I think that was in The Australian, just for our listeners.
Yeah, of course.
Knowledge promoting ID cards, and can you tell us a little bit more about that, I guess, and why they would be so problematic?
Yeah, so I guess the story, and I'm not like overly, I wouldn't say I have an intimate knowledge of the story, but just from what was reported, that somebody had got a confirmation of Aboriginality from one of our organisations, and it's some people from that same organisation have come forth and said that this person's not related to them as they had said they were. And so now we want to tighten these constraints and push for ID cards. So I just look at that just from what I've seen on the media, and I think, well, our organisations, like other organisations, already have in place mechanisms to deal with fraud. Mm. So if somebody has said, I'm related to you, you and you, and that community, and those people have said, no, you're not, that's easily proved as far as I can see. So the push for ID cards, I think, might be a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, and I get why some Aboriginal groups are concerned, because if people do say they're Aboriginal and try and access scholarships or whatever, it can seem really unfair. But I dispute the stats that were in some of those newspaper reports that say that these are high numbers, because we actually scrutinise people pretty well in our organisations.
Yeah.
So what the newspaper reporting does, it says we can't make these decisions for ourselves, that our organisations are all corrupt, and that Aboriginal people don't know what the hell they're doing. And that's what those reports largely say. ID cards are an issue because of our colonial history. What then for people who were stolen or dislocated?
Yeah.
What for those people who can't find, Western forms of evidence to identify themselves, you know, find a paper trail? That's not possible for some people. And if we look at ID cards in the North America or Canada, for that matter, those kind of proving who they are, you get Indigenous people over there who say, oh, I'm non-status, but I'm Cherokee. I'm status, but I am. And the interesting thing that is entwined with gender there is, for some, if you're female and you marry a non-status person, then you lose your status.
So that affects who you might want to marry and who you might want to have children to. It's
Absolutely.
Really scary in a way. It would affect your
personal
choice.
And then 1 minute you're Indigenous and the next you're not?
Yeah.
That's absolute ludicrous. So I think that, you know, sometimes we need to go back to our own ways of understanding who we are, and that is through our kinship ties. You know, this is who I'm related to, this is who I am. I've heard some really, you know, horrific stories from Aboriginal people who have tried to get confirmations of Aboriginality. That's why I just can't conceive that it's such an easy thing, where people go, there's this big rort, everyone's just getting them.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've got one yourself or tried to get one, but, you know, local people in this area have said to me, oh, I've tried to get a confirmation, I needed it for this or whatever, and the experience has been horrific.
Yeah, quite traumatic, you know, for some people, I can imagine.
Yeah, like, we have an organisation that people have to go to, and often when they go there, they're told, well, we don't know you. I mean, our communities aren't just all quite closed as they were prior to 1788.
Yeah.
You know, we move about, you know, we intermarry, we, you know, all sorts of stuff goes on. So it's not quite a clean-cut process that you'd know every Aboriginal person in your local area. So if you have to turn up to a community who is often run by not locals, run by people from all over the country who say, I don't know you and I don't know your family. And the fact is they might not, but then what does that do for the person who may have lived here all their life?
And it's interesting the way this is framed, as if the onus is always on Aboriginal people, because I always felt, well, if it is a white person claiming a benefit, then that's a problem for white Australia, isn't it? It's a white person who's claiming it. It's nothing to do with Aboriginal people and their identity. It's a white person trying to fraud the system. So I have no idea why blackfellas are constantly demonised for it. It should be the white person fraudulently claiming the benefit that's demonised. I'm always amazed by that it goes back to the black community always.
Oh, absolutely, because it still ties back to that idea that you're undeserving.
Yep.
And look at them, they're rorting the system and they don't even know who's Aboriginal, and you can't tell anymore because that person, you know, is probably white. And see how easy it is to rort the system. All this stuff is ludicrous. I had a story of a woman who said that her 13-year-old daughter needed a confirmation of Aboriginality for, I think, some sort of sporting thing that she was involved in. And so she had to go off to one of the organisations, and she did. And the people there on the panel said to her, well, you know, we know that you're an Aboriginal person, but we haven't seen you be active in the community, so we're not going to sign it.
Oh, right. So the identity is signed towards how active they were in the community. It's
absolutely. And if you look at the three-prong definition, it clearly states that you have to openly identify. And to openly identify means you have to do something.
Yeah, right.
So you can't just
there's all different interpretations of that definition that is sort of makes it very broad, and the different ways that Aboriginal organisations use that definition. That's where it all comes from.
Absolutely.
And all the difference come from.
And this definition was, you know, brought about in the late 70s and 80s when governments needed to make make up for past policies. And this, you know, started to really hone in after those two big reports in the 90s as well, the Bringing Them Home report and the Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, where the government was like, you know, we have to try and put something in place, but how are we going to determine who's Aboriginal for the purposes of these programs and services?
Yeah.
And so they put the onus on Aboriginal community organisations to do that. You know, instead of stepping up and speaking to Aboriginal people and coming up with some sort of equitable process that people were agreeable on, they were like, oh, well, you take care of that. That's Aboriginal business.
Do you see that changing anytime soon, that Aboriginal communities might have more of a say in potentially a proper definition?
Well, I'd like to think so, but I haven't seen any move towards that. Perhaps if we become a republic and we negotiate some, you know, ideas around having a treaty, that we might then think about, okay, well, who's Aboriginal for the purposes of coming under the treaty? But it scares me to think of the kinds of things that might take place, which have taken place in other countries.
Whereas some people will be locked out, do you think?
Yes.
Some people will be told, oh, you've been Aboriginal all your life, but you're not Aboriginal anymore.
Absolutely.
Yes,
and I
danger.
Think that's a scary proposition. And we have seen examples of that. I mean, it wasn't that long ago where the Dulles Scott case kind of made all the papers again about identity. And I think the sad thing in that kind of, so he goes off to, you know, get a confirmation, and he's rejected. And he's rejected because they say they don't know him. And this is what I mean about the process being flawed. They might not know him, and they probably didn't know him, but it doesn't mean he's not Aboriginal. But instead of taking on that definition or taking on the actual mechanism, he kind of turned his focus and said, well, look at these fair-skinned people. They're getting these benefits. And again, we followed that line of Andrew Bolt. So we can see how it's embedded in our own way of thinking as well.
Yeah.
You know, really, we should have saying, hey, look at this process. This is horrific. Here's a man who required housing who's actually going to miss out on a fundamental need because the system is flawed. So it's not other people who were fair at skin colouring's fault.
No, it's system.
The system.
And it's all the system we all work in, which is
a lot
of the problems. We're all working within this very white, limited framework. And that's where a lot of problems come from in every area of Aboriginal affairs, I would assume.
And after I graduated with my degree in Aboriginal Studies and Sociology, I went off and got a job managing the community service sector at our local Aboriginal Health Service. And people would come to that service asking for DNA tests because they needed some proof that they were an Aboriginal person. And so all these things, this is all
DNA
sort of impacted
test.
On me writing this book in the end. And I'd say to them, you know, there is no DNA test that proves that you're an Aboriginal person. And they'd be like, I was told I need to get a DNA test. And I don't know if someone was serious about that or just having them on. But, yeah, people would turn up at our service all the time, and this particular health service did not give confirmation of Aboriginality to out. They didn't confirm that document. And so they were sent to the only, you know, organisation in the area that did. And, you know, people had some really bizarre and traumatic experiences trying to get that, where they were told, well, you know, I know your uncle's on the board of that service, but, yeah, we don't recognise you.
God.
And I think, well, if it's about kinship, then if that's his blood uncle, you know.
Yeah.
Then it has to be.
It's amazing. A very complicated debate. And I hopefully get you on in the future to talk about it. I just want to take a break, but we'll keep you on the line. And after that, I want to talk very briefly about your other area of research, which is social media and the way blackfellas use social media, because it feeds into this issue of Aboriginality and identity.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll be back soon. This is... Good morning. Welcome back to Let's Talk. This morning's guest is Professor Bronwyn Carlson, and we're talking about Aboriginal identity, and she's actually written a book, The Politics of Identity. Bronwyn, thanks for coming on the program. I was wondering, I was interested in your other line of research, which is social media and the way blackfellas use social media. How did you actually become interested in this subject coming from your research into identity?
Yeah, I guess the two are really linked. So when I was doing my research for my PhD, I was asking people about how they identify, how they openly identify, because I was following suit from the three-prong definition. And so people would say to me, yeah, but on Facebook I do this. And I'd be like, what? Because I was a bit of a what I call a tech-tard back then. And I was thinking, what? I have to go and check out Facebook and see what people are doing. And so I, you know, had a look at some of the open sites that were on there and started following some of the things that they were doing. So then from then on, I asked my people I was interviewing, so are you on Facebook? Then how do you do it on Facebook? So I wrote a little bit about that in my thesis, and I thought, God, this is so interesting. And so after I, you know, graduated and got a job in academia, I thought, oh, I'm going to apply for an Australian Research Council grant to look at Aboriginal identity and community online. And I did, and I was blown away that I was successful. And I can tell you that I'm so new to academia and didn't understand what was going on. Even the day I got that award, I got sent all these congratulations emails, and I was like, what are they on about? I didn't realise you had to go to the ARC site and on the day and see if you got the award, but lucky I did. So I've spent the last couple of years going out to different communities, and anyone who's listening who would like to you know, ask to come to their communities, give us a yell. We are still collecting data. So we go out into community, we hire a local community person as our liaison person for a week so that they can you know, make sure that we follow correct protocol in different communities. And if there's any language or any other issues we need to be mindful of, that person is our key person on site. And then we interview anyone who's interested, and we talk about what they do on Facebook and around their identity and sense of community. And so, yeah, we've ended up publishing a few papers now, and some great stuff has come out of that.
I guess there's a very diverse number of ways that blackfellas are using Facebook, isn't there? Like, is it different from different parts of the country that you've visited, or different demographics, or what are you sort of seeing as a full picture of how we use Facebook and Twitter and other platforms?
Well, I think that on social media, well, for one, Indigenous people, have always used technology at such a fast rate, and we are indeed overrepresented on Facebook. So we use social media 20% higher than the rest of Australia.
That's amazing.
So we're on there. We're dominating that space. And even in remote communities or more remote communities, like at least 60% of those populations in those places are on social media.
Wow. That's a really great communication tool. I mean, I think about radio, and in the past, radio was the great communication tool and very essential. And I'm wondering if Facebook is the sort of second wave coming through, or things like Twitter in relation to remote communities as well.
Well, I absolutely think so. We've always taken up this technology. You know, if you look at the whole history of Indigenous people with media, including radio, we're always like on there, carving out a space and doing business differently. You know, so if you listen to Indigenous radio stations, very different to mainstream stations.
Yep.
And so this is our way of, you know, sharing knowledge and connecting through those older ways of connecting we've always had. And so social media is no different. I held a conference at UOW just recently all around social media and activism. And the most awesome thing about that was Luke Pearson came and presented, as did Celeste Little. And neither of those two had actually met each other outside of social media.
Yeah.
That was the first time they'd met each other, face-to-face at this, symposium. So, yeah, they were, together there, supporters of all sorts of campaigns, and
yep,
probably knew a lot about each other, and particularly their thinking and their campaigns that they support or not, are similar, yet they'd never actually met physically, which was interesting.
Well, the activism angle, it's really important. I think we saw that in the Stop the Communities campaign. I mean, that was largely driven on social media because mainstream media just didn't pick it up, or they picked it up in a very white-centric way. So it was very much important that social media was around for those protests. So I think
it's
very good tool for activism.
The SOS Black Australia campaign, for example, started off at a very local level with people who were worried about survival, worried about their lives and families, which is usually, you know, what starts the conversation around anything to do with that people want to support. And so they send it out on social media. And so the very fact that we are, you know, so active on there, it becomes this massive campaign. And you're right, you know, mainstream media reported only on one occasion on the close down of Melbourne CBD, and they reported it as selfish rabble closed the city.
Pretty amazing.
So again, you know, Indigenous people are, and their supporters are framed in a way that, well, they don't have to get to work. They've got no work. They have no rights. They're just selfish, disrupting, us. And that's why I thought it was fantastic when you saw what followed that on Twitter was this, hashtag selfish rubble, and people were literally putting up other circumstances where the CBD was closed down for horse racing and sporting events, etc. And so hashtag selfish rubble. So I love Aboriginal people's, commitment in that space and humour.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, because it really showed, come on, this is ridiculous. It certainly was. One of the things at that symposium that was said by another wonderful Aboriginal social media user and blogger is Lisa Watego, and she said, and I hope she doesn't mind me quoting it, because I said to her at the conference, you need to publish that because I'd love to use that. So I'm telling everyone, this was her words, this is her idea. She said that Twitter is, might be we might consider this in the future almost like a midden, where it's like layer upon layer of our conversations and information, and that'll be like this midden, thousands of years old,
and
tracking our thoughts and ideas. And I thought, you know what, that's right. That's what it does.
Pretty amazing vision as well, I think. It's pretty exciting. I only have about 2 minutes left, but I was wondering if people want to get in contact with you or want to be able to buy your book, how would be the best way that they'd be able to?
IATSIS is selling the book, so if you go to their website, and if you use the code IndigenousX, you'll get a 10% discount. If they want to get in contact with me, just Google me at UOW. You'll find all my contact details there. Happy to have conversations with people. My Twitter handle is at Bronwyn Carlson, so I'm easily located. Happy to talk to anyone, and I've actually got a load of emails from people wanting to, one, get the book, but two, just talk about identity in general, and I'm happy to respond.
Yeah, and I can imagine there's not many places where people can actually go and talk about this and find a really educated answer, I guess, and I think you'd be a really good source of information for a lot of people, so I can imagine you'd be flooded.
I am a little flattered, but that's okay because I think it's an important topic and I think it's great that people are interested.
And you're actually talking about online and social media. You're actually on Indigenous X this week, so people can also get onto Twitter and tweet you at Indigenous X, can't they, as well?
Absolutely. I'm there till Thursday night and it's been just a mind-blowing experience to just, you know, to be talking to 25,000 followers and having that kind of engagement. Been wonderful.
That's so great, and it's so good to have you on this morning, and I hope we get you on in the future, because I think I could have talked to you for hours. I think we've only hit the tip of the iceberg, so it's been really good this morning.
The politics of identity is like that.
Definitely. Thanks so much, and I look forward to you reading your book as well, and hopefully talk soon.
Yes, we will.
Thanks for that. That was Professor Bronwyn Carlson, who's at the University of Wollongong. A really interesting conversation we had around the politics of Aboriginal identity, and it's fed in from her. It comes from her book, where she actually looks at the historical legacy, and it informs a lot of the current debates we have around identity and the way it's portrayed in mainstream media, which is obviously very different to the way we talk about it within our own communities. And it's also an issue that a lot of white Australians, they want to know about, but potentially they don't have the access to sort of the level of information that we're talking about in relation to Bronwyn Carlson's book. So I really encourage everyone to get out there and purchase that book. And that's it for me today. I hope everyone has a lovely Wednesday. It's hump day. I hope you get through the rest of your working day week. And I'll be back tomorrow as well, here on 98.9.